Okay, we are here in Doug Van Gundy's kitchen in Elkins, West Virginia. It is the 12th? June 12th, 2018. Could you start by introducing yourself and tell me a little bit about your background and your family in West Virginia?
Sure. So I'm Doug Van Gundy. I'm a seventh generation West Virginian on my mom's side. And a ninth generation West Virginian on my dad's side, although, as so often is the case, those lines went out of state and came back in state. My sixth great grandfather on my dad's side was General Lewis, who founded Lewisburg, and my fourth or fifth great-grandfather on my mom's side was a guy named Eliab Simpson, who came into Monongalia County, and he fought in the Revolutionary War and came into Monongalia County after the war in the late 1700s. But both my parents were born in the Pittsburgh area, and, you know, economic migration. So, but always loved coming back. My mom especially, her family, she still had a great grandmother near Morgantown. And the only other musician that I know of in the family, she played piano for the Silent Pictures in the 20s and would ride from, her farm is now at the bottom of what is now Cheat Lake, but her farm was in that area, and she would ride a horse into Morgantown to play piano for the Silent Pictures before sound came to the movie, so in the late early 20s. Yeah. Only other musician I know of. Well, my dad plays guitar, and my family all sings and everything, so there was a lot of music around the house, but my parents were sort of products of the folk scare of the 60s.
It either goes one way or the other.
Yeah.
How about you? Could you introduce yourself and tell me about your background?
Sure, yeah. So my name's Annie Stroud. I'm originally from Greenbrier County, West Virginia. I was born in a cabin between Williamsburg and Trout. My folks, are not originally from West Virginia. My dad was originally from Wisconsin. His parents were actually missionaries, so he traveled a lot growing up. But going back, actually, my grandfather's family is kind of from, like, Black Mountain, North Carolina area originally. There's a bunch of Strouds there. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. We'll talk about that in a minute. yeah, and so my little brother went to West Virginia Wesleyan, where Doug teaches, and they actually figured out that we're probably related way back, because you've got Strouds.
The Strouds of Stroudsburg, PA, are a direct lineage of mine through my dad, and those same Strouds are relatives of Annie's, so.
Yeah. So probably. So I grew up, you know, I was born there. My brothers were born in Greenbrier County. My folks moved there during the 70s. My dad bought a farm. And they, so both my parents played music. They actually met at the Augusta Heritage Center in a hammer dulcimer class. And my dad also plays fiddle and mandolin and guitar, but he hasn't played for a while since they used to play in a contra dance band. On my dad's side, my grandmother also played music. She was a classical violinist and viola player, and I actually have her fiddle now that I play regularly. And then on my mom's side, they did a lot of singing, but on her father's side, actually, they're all from East Texas, and so they come from kind of like French-speaking, you know, Cajun background there, but my mom's growing up was kind of rough, so she didn't really meet that family until she was in college, after she was already doing French, which was actually kind of crazy. She, like, majored in French and then all of a sudden realized she had this whole family that just spoke French, which was kind of cool. But, so they, you know, my grandfather would, like, play the accordion and things like that around the house. And she grew up in New England, and so did contra dance and square dance and a lot of kind of New England style fiddle tunes from around there.
Where?
So she was living, she was born in Boston area. She lived in Malden for a while. And then when she met my dad, she was actually living in Norwich, Vermont. She was teaching there. And so I almost was raised in Vermont instead of West Virginia. My dad had actually just bought the farm. So there's, I guess, a period of time, 6 months, where they were driving back and forth every 2 weeks to see each other. And she ended up, there was a really good, like, back-to-the-lander community in the Lewisburg area that I think was really welcoming. So she was able to, like, make Lewisburg work for a French teacher from New England. Yeah, and then I started playing, I guess, my dad made me beg for a year before I was allowed to start an instrument. Because he had tried to learn from his mother, and it had not worked at all. So he picked the fiddle up again much later in life. So we actually, I took from outside teachers and did classical starting, I think, when I was eight or nine. And then mostly I just played classically until I was probably, 12 or so is when I started playing the, New England style Irish tunes that my parents played. And I played both, I guess, on through that. And we went to, like, some of the festivals around West Virginia and things like that, so I got to know a bunch of people in the area. My dad was friends with Jimmy Costa, but he was always just, like, my dad's old friend, so I never, like, hung out with him and realized what a gem he was until later. My dad sells antiquarian books, so they had a lot to talk about. Yeah. They had a lot to talk about.
You want to talk about starting to play music?
Sure. So my first instrument was the guitar, and I learned from my dad. I learned a little bit from my dad. I learned a lot from my uncle, who my father had taught. Which is very strange, but I was much more interested in learning it from my younger uncle, who was sort of like right between us in age. He was like 12 years older than me, and my dad's like 28 years older than me. So, my younger uncle, he was hip, but when he was 14 or 15, he was learning from my dad, who was teaching him, like, the pop songs of the day. So, but dad played, was, like, really influenced by Ian and Sylvia and Tom Paxton and people like that, Cisco Houston and Utah Phillips and people like that. His favorite musician was Joni Mitchell. Mm-hmm. Is Joni Mitchell. And just loved Joni. So I grew up in a house that was full of acoustic music, but not real folk music, not traditional music. And then when I went out to college, when I went out to Utah, I played in a garage hardcore punk band, and was really interested and involved in the punk scene in Salt Lake. And then I was laying on the couch one night, I'd come back from a party, and there was a great community radio station in Salt Lake, KRCL, Radio Free Utah. And there was a guy named Brad Raunch who owned the punk rock radio station, or the punk rock record store. And he had a show called Behind the Zion Curtain. And it was on from like 11 until 4 in the morning on Saturday night. And so I came back from this party and I turned it on. I fell asleep on the sofa listening to it. And when I woke up, this show called Sagebrush Serenade, which was bluegrass and old time, was on. And I woke up because Hazel Dickens was singing West Virginia, My Home. And I hadn't been home in like 2 years. And I used to see Hazel a lot when I was a kid, growing up in Elkins through Augusta. And Hazel and Alice did a concert that I remember going to in the basement of the Methodist Church when I was about 10. And just hearing that, and I like heard those words as someone who was living away from West Virginia for the first time. And I'd grown up hearing it all, and that's Hazel and Alice. But hearing it as someone who's now on the outside, it just tore me up. And the next song that the DJ played was Norman Blake flat picking Forked Deer. And I went and sold my electric guitar and got an acoustic. I thought, that's what I'm going to do with the guitar now. I'm going to learn how to do that. Mm-hmm. And so for another 10 years, or 8 years, I tried to flat pick and play old time tunes, but play them on the guitar, flat pick them, and sing older songs. I got into old country, like Charlie Poole and the Carter Family and Uncle Dave Macon and stuff like that. And when Melissa and I got married, her grandmother, like most people do, we took the bulk of our honeymoon as a beach vacation with 15 relatives and rented a house at the shore and Delaware shore. And so I had my guitar and I was always playing out on the porch, and Melissa's grandmother said, "Do you ever play the violin?" And I said, sort of mostly out of politeness, "No, but I've always liked it. I've always thought that would be a cool thing to be able to do." And so we went to her house at Christmas, and she said, "There's something for you under the bed." And I went, and it was her violin. She had played classical violin in the Ohio All-State Junior High and High School orchestras. And she apparently had been very good. She was like second chair. And first chair went to Juilliard. And the woman she beat for second chair went to Ohio State and had a career teaching music. And she put the fiddle under the bed and became a farm wife and never played again, which is kind of a sad story. But she gave me her fiddle, and I thought, oh, I had to learn something to thank her at least. And that next summer I was in a community theater production with Dwight Diller, banjo player, lives in Pocahontas County. And we started talking, and he started giving me cassettes of his field recordings that he had made of the Hammonds family, and said, "Listen to this, don't touch the fiddle, come back next week." And so I would go to his house, and for about 8 months, "You're doing great, listen to this." And so it was the Hammonds family, but it was also Lee Triplett and Ira Mullins and some of these Clay County musicians that he had known, Wilson, and Mose Kaufman and Lee Hammonds. And the players that I liked the best were Lee Hammonds and Mose Kaufman and Eden and Sherman. And Eden was by far the most polished, but like, and then Mose, and then Sherman and Lee both had kind of a really archaic style of playing. But I love that music. But he said, "You're doing great, don't touch the fiddle. And then oddly enough, Jimmy Costa played a really important part for me too, because my wife and I had gone down to Charleston to see a taping of Mountain Stage. And we were driving back, and we stopped in an Italian restaurant in Beckley to have dinner, a late dinner, and Jimmy was in there. And I had met Jimmy through WVMR, through the radio station. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, I'm learning to play the fiddle. And he says, "Oh, that's great. Who's teaching you?" And I said, "Dwight." He said, "Well, Dwight knows what it should sound like." He said, "Does he play the fiddle?" And I said, "Not really." And at that time, he didn't. I mean, he does now, but he didn't really play then. And I said, "But he's been giving me these tapes and stuff." He said, "Well, you should go see Mose Kaufman." I said, "Well, I've been listening to him, but I didn't know he was still alive." He goes, "Oh, yeah, he's in the nursing home at Fairleigh." And so that was a Sunday evening. And Tuesday, I got off work and drove to Fairleigh and just went up and asked where he was. And I was working at the radio station, so I borrowed a big Tascam, like, reporter deck and a cable and mic, and took my fiddle and went up. And I, on the way home, and I walked in, and Mose was like, "Oh, nice to meet you." And I said, "I heard you're a really good, I've heard of recordings of you, and do you still play the fiddle?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, yeah." And I said, "Well, I really want to learn." He goes, "Okay." I mean, it was like that simple. And he said, I said, "Really?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "Do you have a fiddle?" And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Do you have a tape recorder?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Where are they?" I said, "They're in the car." He said, "Well, what good do they do you there?" And I said, "Hold on." So I like went downstairs and out to the car and got the gear and came up. And that first day he played for me for about 3 hours in the day room, just surrounded by other residents. And he was confined to a wheelchair. And so I helped him out of the wheelchair and onto a straight back chair, and he played for me for about 3 hours, and he kept handing me the fiddle. I'm like, "I don't know anything. Now you play one." "No, I don't know." And so pretty much every other week for about a year I went. And after, I don't know, the fourth or fifth time I visited him, I ran into Jerry Milnes, and from the Augusta, who was working at the Augusta Heritage Center as the folk arts coordinator. And I told him that I was learning to play fiddle from Mose Kaufman. And Dwight had said, I'm finished with you. That's it. You know, you've got your teacher now. Mm-hmm. And Jerry said, well, we've got these apprenticeships. You should really, you know, I kind of need somebody. This is a perfect fit. Just apply.
Yeah.
There's no question that Mose is a master artist and everything. And I've never been able to find anyone to go down and work with him. I've been dreaming of this. And I'd really like to see it happen. And so we applied, and Mose didn't want to do it because he said, I'm on a fixed income, and if they give me any money, it's gonna throw off my, and I don't want to mess up, you know, Social Security and staying in the nursing home. And so actually the way that we worked it out is that we bought him a bunch of Levi Garrett chewing tobacco, which is what it's like, it was his one indulgence was chewing tobacco. And bought for the project a Marantz deck and 100 blank cassettes and EV-635 field mic. And that was the grant. It was like the cheapest grant they ever did. It was like, here's a tape player, some tape, and some chewing tobacco. Go and spend a year together.
Nice.
But I was 27 when I started playing the fiddle.
Okay. And that's with
Mose. And that was with Mose. Yeah, I'd never played before. He was the guy who got me started. And he had never taught anyone from the ground up. He'd taught people tunes here and there, but he had no children. And nobody had ever sort of gone to him and said, will you please show me how to play the fiddle? So,
why don't you talk a little bit about how he would teach you and what he taught you?
So the way that he would teach me was with one fiddle and one fiddle only. And we usually used mine because he said, I love to play a strange fiddle. So we would sit sort of knee to knee. He didn't like being in the day room because there were a lot of people sort of with dementia and stuff around. They'd make a lot of noise and they'd grab at things. And he did a rather funny imitation of that kind of person, which surprised me the first time. He kind of, you know, made this eyes rolled back face. He said, we don't want to be around them while we're doing this. We want to be able to do our thing. So we found a little supply room with no windows in the basement that they would let us use. And so I would put the fiddle across the arms of his wheelchair and push him into the elevator. We'd go to the basement. We'd go to this little supply room, and which was a quarter of the size of this kitchen. And it was really just like a supply closet, a big thing with a light bulb in it. And we'd sit knee to knee. Sometimes we'd be in an activity room if it was free, but mostly we'd sit down in this little room and we'd sit knee to knee, and he'd play for me on the fiddle, and then he'd hand it to me, and I would play him the tune that I had been working on, and he'd take the fiddle back and he'd say, yeah, you're doing real good on it, you're getting it. And then he would play the parts that I missed real slow. He would never tell me, this is what you're missing. He would just play the parts that I missed real slow, and I'd be like, oh, and he would hand it back. He said, play it for me one more time. And then I would play it and, you know, try to fix it. And it was just that way. It was a conversation, but we never talked over each other. It was always a conversation where the fiddle was passing mm-hmm. between hands. And
he would tell stories too?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he would talk about the fiddlers he learned from. And he loved to tell about meeting Ed and Hammonds at the state fair. And he'd love to tell this story about a fiddler from Webster County named Jim Short that he learned a tune from in a beer joint that's for the longest time at Spring Creek, as you're headed up over, there's a place off to the right, there was a beer joint forever. And Mose was up in there, and this guy came in with a fiddle, and they got to talking, and he said, well, buy me a beer and I'll show you a tune you never heard. And he taught him this tune. He said actually that Eden used to do that too. He carried his fiddle around in a flour sack, and he would go into bars and he would play. And he was so renowned as a fiddler, and people just loved his fiddling. But he would play one tune, and then somebody buy him a beer, he'd play another tune. And that was the way it went. But yeah, it's a great way to drink if you can get away with it. I actually had that happen to me in Pittsburgh one time. Yeah, but anyway, that's another story. But yeah, so he would tell stories about growing up in Frankfurt and about being drafted at age 37, 38, and about living in Guam and fighting during World War II. Well, he didn't fight. He was in World War II. He was a supply sergeant. And so the Pacific Fleet was partially supplied out of Guam. And so he was stationed on Guam, and he was supplying, you know, battleships and destroyers and aircraft carriers. Yeah. And he was in the Air Force for 10 years, and then one of his parents got sick, and he came home. And never left. Then he was in Guam and Texas, and then he came back. But he was in a band in Texas called the White Rock Mountain Boys. It was like a bunch of guys on the bass, and they play on the local radio, and they... But then
he,
not that I've been able to find, it would have been in the, you know, late 40s.
Yeah, most radio stations
didn't keep record. No. Ephemeral.
Yeah.
But yeah, and he would talk about his work life. He worked as an orderly. After his parents died, he worked as an orderly at the Denmark State Hospital, which was the state tubercular hospital for the colored. Was how it was established. And that's how he got to know Lee Hammonds, because Lee volunteered down there or worked down there for a while. And they became friends, and through Lee he got to know Sherman and Burl, and became friends with them. Eden's son, James, used to come and stay with Moe's in Frankfurt for the winter. And he would spend a lot of time fishing and hunting through the summer, but he would come and live at Moe's house through the winter. And he said they would, you know, there wasn't a lot of work to do, wasn't much to do, and they would just play the fiddle all winter long. And
cool.
Yeah.
So. Do you want to talk about playing, learning to play at festivals and those variations?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, my parents listened to a lot of folk music when I was growing up, obviously kind of, again, folk revival world. And it was a little bit funny because my mom was raised very secular. They were Methodist, I think, but she grew up in Boston and wore miniskirts. And my dad was raised not listening to the radio and not playing cards and not going to the movies. So they had a pretty funny musical taste. My mom would know some things, and then my dad had a couple things that he listened to all the time. But they both got really into the folk music. so we didn't listen to a lot of old time proper, you know, West Virginia old time, I guess, growing up. But he had tons and tons of cassettes of New England style tunes, and they would go up there. They had some friends that they would go and play music with, and they went to a bunch of festivals. So I really first started hearing old time going to some of those. So we go to Vandalia, and we go to Foot Mad used to put on a festival in Fayetteville. I think it was just called the Foot Mad Fall Fest. Yeah, and it was a really sweet little festival. It was at a Boy Scout camp outside of town. Yeah. And it was...
I played that a couple of times
yeah.
In the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. You may have been there as a kid.
I probably was. Yeah, it was a great festival. That's actually where I met Melvin Wine, too. So they would bring people
yeah.
in. So he did, a workshop, and I was, 10 and too scared to talk to anyone. So.
When were you 10?
98.
Melvin was there the year. That was the year that we played.
Okay.
We played one of the dances. I was in a band called the Yehos before Born Old with the third member, Pam Lund. And we played that year.
That's
yep,
cool.
Melvin was there.
Yeah, my mom, I was a really shy kid, so my mom was like, you have to go sit up front and ask him questions, and of course I did not, at all. But yeah, so we started going to festivals, and my classical teacher, this was a little bit later, but I guess maybe when I was 14, 13 or 14, is a guy who's still in Lewisburg, Adam DeGraff, and he's a fantastic classical violinist. He does like rock violin stuff now too. But he's a really, really excellent teacher. And when he first moved to West Virginia, him and his wife had a place in Monroe County, actually, like kind of out of, like in the middle of nowhere. And so he used to teach out of Union. And he would have, he played with, what's the guy that played piano? He's a really good like ragtime piano player.
From West Virginia?
I think he lived around the Lewisburg area. He played with Adam. They had a band called Piano Fiddle for a while. I can't remember his name right now. Anyways, he's since passed. But anyways, Adam was really into that. So he would have and try and bring musicians in. So he would have, there was a kid that learned from Jimmy Costa named Jared Nutter, and he would have Jake Crack come down, and do like joint concerts along with like some of Adam's like really advanced classical students too. So it was pretty cool to do that. So I was exposed to it kind of from like the teaching perspective at that point, kind of at the same time as I was like meeting people at these festivals. And I mean, I think FootMad also did a really good job of a couple years. They did, the organization for that festival was all volunteer. So depending on who stepped up that year, some years it was really organized and some years it wasn't. But a couple years it was pretty organized and they had some like bring the youth together things. So I think like 1 year, you know, they brought like, they had Adam Hurt was there and Rachel Eddy and Elizabeth Laprell and Jared, and I don't know if Jake came that year or not, but there was a bunch of young people all of a sudden that were playing this kind of music, whereas previously the young people had mostly been dancing and being shy on the edge of jams. That was me. And so that year especially was kind of the first year I think that I saw that the like community around the music and was like really excited about it kind of on my own outside of my parents, because it had always been kind of my parents' thing. I also danced a lot, so my interest was mostly actually in the dancing for a while as a kid. And yeah, so that's when I started learning some of the more standard tunes, which I still don't know all of, but that's okay. You know, and I think it wasn't until, you know, so I would see those folks a lot. I did a lot of contra dance too in college, and so I would run into some of those folks at kind of contra dance things, but those scenes are a little bit separated. And then when I was in college, I made friends with a guy from Tennessee, Joe Overton, who's a great musician now. And when he was the first student I think I met at my audition for Hiram College. I was like talking to the music director, and she's like, "Oh, you should meet Joe. He's learning how to play the banjo." You know, so that was fun. He was a good buddy for years and years. But he was super into old time and really excited about it. And so we did a lot of playing there with some folks in school. And that's when I started to learn a bunch of the festival tunes. You know, the kind of like tunes that everybody plays and has kind of the same version of, so everyone can play it. You know. Which was really fun, because those were like brand new to me at the time. I hadn't even heard those really yet. So we did a lot of that. I was involved with like a student environmental group growing up, so we did a lot of these like big, like Mountain Justice summer camps, and there was a lot of good musicians that ended up at those, so we played a lot of music there, you know, with the like, I don't know, I guess kind of like anarchist punk kid lyrics, you know, of course. So that was really fun. But yeah, I don't know. And then I moved back to, after college, I traveled for a while. We did seasonal work. I spent 2 summers in Alaska and played a whole bunch of music up there. There was a old guy named Knut Tonga, who was a fantastic musician, and him and his wife both play old time music. I think they've divorced, but we played in like a band. We met a guy that played mandolin, and Alaska's a really good place to play music in bars because they don't get a lot of outside music, so they're very excited to pay you to play. Yeah, it's a little friendly tip there. But anyways, Knut started playing with us quite a bit, and he knew all sorts of stuff, and he was really into old country too, so he would like sing old country songs with us. And that's, I think, when we started hanging out with Knew it was when I started getting a little bit more into maybe like the fiddlers and the music from West Virginia. He didn't necessarily play West Virginia music, but he had a really strong connection to his family musical tradition, I guess, and like talked about it often. So I started thinking about it more. And then we moved back to West Virginia in 2012, I guess, is when we moved back. And yeah, I think that's really when my partner was playing banjo and guitar and things like that at the time too, and getting more into it. And we moved back to Lewisburg. And there's, you know, there's, at the time there was several pretty good old-time musicians in the area. Yeah, that's when I think I first got really excited about it, I guess. Yeah.
Cool. Why don't you talk about how this apprenticeship came about and what your goals are?
Well, so kind of on the same vein of like really being interested. So like I said earlier, my dad was friends with Jimmy Costa, but Jimmy was just my dad's friend. And, you know, so like I always knew him, and like he'd mentioned to me before, you know, like, oh, there's a fiddler like up from where around you all were. And so I'd heard a couple of these names before, but I never met any of those folks because my folks didn't, you know, when my dad moved to the area, he met a lot of local people, and he worked for a woman. There's a woman named Mrs. Toothman who her family owned a bunch of property, and she was apparently, I wish I could have met her because he has great stories about her. Apparently she was like pretty snarky and had all of the dirt on everybody in the area, but was also like a wealth of knowledge. So my dad worked for her and lived in one of the properties she owned. That's the cabin I was actually born in. So I really wish I would have known her, because he was able to kind of get integrated in the community somewhat when he first came in through her, but at that time, like, wasn't like asking about musicians or anything like that, because I think, you know, Mose was obviously still alive at that point, and some of these folks were still around, maybe. But these names had always just kind of been, like, up here, because, like, I knew about the Hammonds family, I knew about Henry Reed, you know, there were some of these names that came up more, but there's always this, like, you know, you Google search Mose Kaufman, and, like, not much comes up. And I don't remember how it was that I found out that you had learned from Mose.
I learned from Jimmy.
Maybe? I don't remember now, actually. Or maybe it was maybe it was from Cal. So my little brother went to Wesleyan. So my brother actually knew Doug. I mean, so like I had seen Doug at things before, but we never really like hung out or talked or anything. Yeah, we never met properly. But my brother went to Wesleyan, like would come home raving about one of his professors that he just loved. He really, really loved her classes. And like how I had to meet him and how it would be so cool and all these things. My brother's 7 years younger than I am. And
a lovely human being also.
Yeah, he's a sweet kid. He really is. My brother sings, was a vocal performance person. So he sings like operatic, which is the opposite of me. So.
And an amazing singer. An amazing singer too. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just, and just like Annie, just really curious and really bright-eyed and optimistic and wide open and charming in that way. I think because he would always tell me, you know, my sister plays the fiddle. You know, you should meet my sister sometime. And I think the first time we actually like met was last summer at Augusta when we were both judging the fiddle contest with David O'Dell.
And it was so fun because we, like, beforehand we had, like, a little powwow about, like, what kind of tunes we liked.
What are we looking for here?
Like, what are we looking for in these fiddle tunes? And so, like, you know, I've always been drawn, and, like, the more I've listened to more music, and there's a fiddler in Roncevert named Dennis Ott who's a funny guy. I like him a lot. But he had a ton of field recordings. Of, you know, he's the one that like gave me my initial like Hammonds one, and the like 300 song Melvin collection, and all those all came from Dennis. So I really liked a lot of that kind of that style of fiddling, especially because, you know, also in college. So my boyfriend at the time, he he grew up playing punk and then had a bunch of friends that started playing bluegrass. So we also played a bunch of like bluegrass stuff in kind of like right after college and things like that, because he plays mandolin and those kinds of things. So, which I enjoy as well, but it's a different, right. You know, it's a different thing. Right. So it was really fun to like get to talk about that and be like, oh, okay, we're on the same page, you know, about those kinds of things. But yeah, I don't remember. I might have found out about that you learned from Moe's then, even. Did we talk about that?
We talked about it a little bit then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then sort of later that, not too much later, mm-hmm. we exchanged contact information.
Yeah.
And not that much later, Annie was like, hey, I want to apply for this thing. What do you think? And I was...
You're the right person. Like, you know the things I need to know.
I was sort of stunned, because I just thought, well, I kind of come to the conclusion that, well, I just do what I do, because so much of the fiddling that you hear anywhere is just, it's really ornate and people are really all about playing really fast and really Baroque, even the old time kind of players play and really sweet and really smooth, and I listened to all those old guys and none of them played sweet and smooth. I mean, they had like teeth and grit, and that's the stuff, that's what I loved about punk. That's and I had grown up going to the square dances in Elkins, and for me growing up, like, Woody Simmons was the fiddler here, and so I'd known Woody all my life, and I would occasionally hear Jerry would bring Melvin over. Michael Klein, the great guitar player who's done a lot of field recording and a lot of work, actually still lives up the street here, but I've known him since I was a kid. And I'd hear Ernie Carpenter and people like that. And all of those players had that just that edge to their playing that I grew up and loved and then was grew to be embarrassed by, you know,
right.
Like learned to be embarrassed by it. And then realized how much I missed it. And when I came back to it, I realized that's part of, I think punk rock and old time music are really, really close in terms of like, it's music that you can spend a little bit of time learning to play and then play with other people.
Right, it's participatory.
It's participatory, it's kind of DIY, and the ethos, even among the old people, it's this sense of community and like, sure, I'll show you. I mean, there's this real generosity. This is, you know, what I have is yours. And so it always saddens me when I see like old time players get proprietary about like, you know, well, here's a tune you don't know. And just that, it just bugs me. But I had sort of resigned myself. I've been playing with an incredible banjo player and guitar player named Paul Gartner for, well, 21 years this year, as this band Born Old. And we, he has the same sort of attitude that I have. It's like, well, we just do what we do. And so, you know, I go to Glenville and I go to Vandalia and you play in the contest and stuff. And, you know, somebody who's doing all these bow tricks and stuff wins. And I just, I have the worst attitude towards playing in contests, because like I always go up there and I play like the droniest, most authentic in my mind tune that I can possibly play. Like I know, and I won't name any names, but I know that like fiddlers XYZ and Q are up there and they're gonna play these really fast and really fancy crowd pleasers, and I'm gonna get up there and play something like that's in cross and that's really drony. I'm just gonna get up there and just, you know, that's the punk rock attitude too. Like I'm just gonna get up there and make sure that at least once on that stage something really old gets played, and with the idea that I'm, you know, throwing myself in front of the train, and it's okay. But I just thought, well, I just do what I do, and then to have somebody, and I did for a number of years. I taught almost full time. I taught like 20, 25 students a week on fiddle, banjo, guitar, mandolin, ukulele, but you know, teaching them rudiments and teaching them standard kind of tunes and stuff, but that someone would want to learn to play the kind of tunes that are closest to my heart, and the ones that I play at home for myself, was kind of surprising to me. It felt like it was out of left field. And so, and especially because learning from Mose seems so close. I mean, it's been Mose died 24 years ago last month. So he died May 12th, 1994. And so we started working together, you know, 25 years ago, but it just seems so close. And it just surprised me that like, enough time had gone by and I'd played enough that somebody would want to learn the tunes that I knew. And then when I found out that Annie was from, like, you know, 10 miles from where Mose was from, and I realized that my style and the tunes that I play, my repertoire and style, are really like the Greenbrier Valley. It's from the Hammonds family to Henry Reed. It's straight down. It's Pocahontas, Greenbrier, and Monroe counties. That's the stuff that I play. And I realized that's where Annie's from, and that's where I learned. And I was living in Pocahontas County when I was learning. I was living in Marlinton. I lived there for 12 years. And so even though I was surprised at first, I realized pretty quickly because Annie's really wonderful and just, you know, smart and a quick study and personable and fun to be around and all of those things, but also that her head and heart were in a place where, you know, I think we pretty quickly figured out, oh, this is a really good fit. I think it's just like, oh, this is, yeah, this is, it's, and then when we're done, we're like, oh, damn, we're out of time. You know, it's always so much fun. And
why don't you talk about how you learn, how you work together in the apprenticeship, and also learning some of the tunes that are from, and stories that are from where you grew up.
Yeah, sure. So this was an interesting, you know, so I think our apprenticeship is different than Doug's and Moses were, in that, like, I'm coming into it, you know, with, like, a pretty high technical skill.
And I knew nothing. I'm serious. I knew nothing. I could play zero tunes when I started my apprenticeship. Zero.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, Annie's a better technical fiddler than I am. She's got the training. So.
Yeah, but I didn't, you know... So one of the things that's been really... that, like, I think I came, like, pretty much off the bat to Doug for was, like, I'm coming from this background of, like, really specific, like, bowing and sound and, like, standards for what's appropriate, right? That I'm, like, have been kind of, like, breaking down and splitting up, you know? Like, I can turn it on if I need to. You know, so we definitely, I think, have been... We don't do a whole lot of, like, learning the tune in the lesson itself. So, like, Doug will tell me about the tune, like, what it is, usually play it for me. Because I've been really focused on trying to get the bowings, because for myself, coming from, again, so I played classically, and I also played a lot of Irish tunes, which have, you know, a lot of similarities, but again, the, like, not generic, but kind of, like, generic Irish music that's played in the U.S. is very clean and very Baroque and all those kinds of things, you know, and when I was getting a little bit more into it when I was in high school, and I started listening to, like, the Irish fiddlers, like the regional ones, you're like, oh, okay, like, this is the same scene.
Well,
but you don't hear that.
Me too, yeah. listening to older Irish fiddlers,
yeah.
and like what's his name, Morrison, they called him the old professor, and even like Bobby Casey and
oh, yeah.
Going way back, and Michael Coleman, like, to me, Michael Coleman and Edwin Hammonds sound so much alike, like,
yeah.
that absolute intensity and that wire edge, that just incredible breathlessness. But when I started hearing the regional Irish players, I was like, oh no, that was sanitized. This is, yeah, and Scots fiddlers too.
Yeah,
you hear that. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I'd seen that in Irish music, and, like, you know, and then had gotten more interested in old time, and, like, technically for me, realizing that a lot of that for me is in my boat because I play very cleanly and those kinds of things. I also, for every lesson, like, record it so I can listen to it and learn, and then also do a video so I can try and figure out the bowings, because that does, I have a tendency, again, just to clean things up, so, you know, whether or not I need to. So I have to, like, think about that quite a bit. And I also have a notebook, so I try and write down. I've got a section that's kind of, like, facts, or stories, myths about Moes, I guess, that I write down as I come across them. And then, you know, I've been keeping track of, like, which teams we're working on and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, it's a different time, so the technology helps, but really Annie didn't need help learning how to learn a tune. Like, I needed to learn how to learn a tune, and Annie doesn't need that. And so it's as she described, although oftentimes we will start the part she left out is we'll start, and I'll have her play what she's been playing for me. And I'll be like, okay, you're almost getting it there. You put in an ornament that's not there, or there is a little ornament that you're not hearing. And I'll try to show her as close as I can. When you've played this music for 25 years, I kept thinking, I've learned so much from this apprenticeship, first of all, about, like, my own playing, and it's forced me to go back and look at some of the tunes that I have been playing, and I've found more in that music. But you can't help but play like yourself. Mm-hmm. And Moes used to say that to me all the time, and I say this to Annie at least once a lesson, yeah. Once a meeting. And Moes would say to me about once a meeting, he'd say, don't ever try to play just like me. You got to be your own fiddler. Mm-hmm. And he would also say, there are 100 ways to play a tune right and only one way to play it wrong. And, I mean, he's very, like, Zen master about a lot of this stuff. And I'd be like, what do you mean there's only one way to play it wrong? And or he'd say, there's two kinds of fiddling. There's two kinds of music, good and bad.
I would agree.
And, yeah, absolutely. And it's like, oh, okay. And then he would share with me, like, these kind of things that other people would say. Like, he said that Sherman Hammond said, it's all in the bow, boys. It's all in the bow. And that's, I think that's true. I believe that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there was a point in there somewhere that I think I missed the exit on. I have Annie. So in our lessons, have Annie play. And sometimes we'll play together. And I think the greatest thing, though, that I've noticed in Annie's playing is her willingness to take technique that she knows and is really comfortable with and set it aside and adopt technique that initially wasn't as comfortable. And especially the East Central fiddlers that I like, East Central West Virginia fiddlers that I like the best, they kind of bow inside out of how you'd expect a tune to be bowed. There's a lot of accents on the up bow, on the push. Uh-huh. And so, and a lot of using that to create drones in alternative tunings. So we've played in four different tunings now. Yeah. And I play in seven or eight. There's a couple that we haven't gotten to yet.
That is one thing that's really different for me too, because, I mean, again, like, coming from classical for years and years and years, you know, Irish tunes aren't played out of alternative tunings. I mean, there's a couple, but not really. And then, like, when I would go, and, you know, so, like, I was really influenced by a couple of fiddlers, you know, like Rachel Eddy in Morgantown was always, you know, super duper welcoming, like, young woman fiddler who was like, hey, you can do this, like, come play tunes with me, like, come eat a veggie hot dog with me, like, let's go do these things, you know, which is really, really encouraging, again, especially for, like, a shy homeschooler, you know, like, so she was really, really great in that way, but she's a really, you know, she's definitely come from, like, a tradition of learning, for sure, but she's a pretty clean fiddler as well, you know, she's, like, really polished, she works really hard at it, and, you know, I went to a lot of jams where, like, everyone else would tune down for, you know, tune day or whatever, and, you know, Rachel will play almost everything at a standard most of the time. Yeah, she really, I mean, she's an incredible fiddler. You know, and I have coming from classical background, I have the technical skill that I can usually do that, even though some tunes are just very awkward if you don't put them in the right spot. You know, so that was something that has, you know, I had started to play in Cresting. You know, I did an Augusta week with Dave Bing up here. And, you know, I'd gone to some things and, like, had started to learn some Cresting tunes, but I really didn't play them much. Like, I would tune day, muddle around. You know, it's very scary coming from a classical background to change your strings to, like, be something that not what they are. You know, and so that was another thing that we talked about specifically working on was, like, all right, I mean, I think the first, like, 8 tunes we learned were all in, like, cross G or something like that, you know, which was, like, super great. And, you know, being able to really, like, appreciate the nuance in that tuning, I guess, has been really fun.
Well, and in my experience, I never played in standard tuning for the first year and a half that I played. I'm serious. I never learned a tune out of, like, standard, what Moog called natural tuning.
And what was that, cross G?
No, EADG, like, or GDAE. Moog always went high to low. And most people talk about low to high, so I still have to turn it around. But yeah, GDAE, standard classical tuning. I didn't play a single tune in that tuning for the first, until after Moog died.
Oh, but what were you playing in? You were playing in cross
A? I was playing in cross A. So I was playing in AEAE. Mm-hmm. I was playing in ADAE. Mm-hmm. So that would be high bass.
Okay.
AE would be high bass, high counter.
That's what he called it.
Oh, so the low string is the bass string, the second string is the counter string. Mm-hmm. And then the third string, I can't remember her name, and then the fine string. Mm-hmm. So it was like bass, counter,
something.
A, and the fine string.
Huh.
And so that's what I use it for, is mostly tunes in the key of D, but there's also a ton of modal tunes that are in A modal that have to be played in that tuning in order for them to lay right and in order for the drones to happen. And Moog would say, you can play all of these out of natural, but they won't ring right. And so I was playing in A cross, G cross, high bass, and AEA C sharp, which some people call, in North Carolina they call it calico, but we don't have that tune up here, so we don't call it calico. I call it the Lost Indian tuning.
Would that be like a round peak style in North Carolina? Or?
Yeah, calico is a North Carolina, like a round peak North Carolina tune. So, but the tunes that we would play in that, like the Hammonds had a bunch of really beautiful, lonesome sounding tunes in that, the Piney Woods, Three Forks of Cheat, Cows in the Pea Patch, those are all in that. Moog played a beautiful tune called The Lost Indian, although every time he played it he said, but have you ever heard of a lost Indian? I mean, he was a very funny guy. He was very, very funny. He had a great sense of humor. But yeah, so there, and then a little bit in DADD. So.
And what do you call that?
He called that. What did he call that? He said of it that it was to mock a Scottish bagpipe, to imitate a bagpipe. And so, like, he played a version of Washington's March that was down in there, and he played Bonaparte's Retreat that was down in that tuning.
Cool.
So, yeah, very little. He made a whole cassette for me. One whole session he was in standard, and he played all these G tunes, but I didn't learn them until after he died. And so, yeah, it was after he died that I got into standard and started to learn some of those tunes.
And you just did 1 year of apprenticeship?
So we started working together in March of 93, March 9th of 1993, and he died May 12th of 1994. So that was the end. And he had a stroke a few weeks before that. And I went in to see him, and he said, I think I've had a stroke. He said, because I can't really work my left hand anymore. And he said, why don't you just play for me? And so the last time I visited for him, we sat in his room. I'd never been to his room before. And I sat in his room and played for him. And then I drove down to Ronsford. There was like a Magic Mart or some kind of a, like, little, I don't know what it's called. No, it's like a Kmart, but...
Well, we have Kmart and a Magic Mart. It's closed now.
Okay. Well, anyway.
We have both.
But that's... It was down there on the right as you went down into Ronsford.
In Ronsford, or you mean Fairly?
No, I mean in Ronsford.
Ronsford, on the right?
Cross the river, and you kind of come around as you're headed south on 219, and it was right there on the right. And there was like a... fast food place in the front, some fast food, maybe. Anyway, I went down to some, it was the nearest one I could think of. I went down to some store that had a toy department. I bought like a squishy stress ball kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And I went back to the nursing home and took it to him and said, well, maybe if you'd squeeze this, maybe this would help. Maybe this would. Mm-hmm. And then I got a phone call that he had died. Wow. But it was, that was maybe 8 days later. After he thought he had the stroke, and he told me that he would always tell me that, you know, he had no kids and that he loved when I would visit and when people would come around, but he loved playing the fiddle, and he said, you know, the day I can't play the fiddle is the day I want to lay down and die. Mm-hmm. And he had the stroke and he couldn't play the fiddle, and it was about 8 or 10 days later he was dead. He also always said to me, not always, but in the last 3 or 4 months when we were working together, he said, you know, I'd like to give you my fiddle, but I promised it to my nephew. Mm. And, which is fine, because the fiddle that we played on and all the recordings I have is the fiddle that I still, yeah, that I own, mm-hmm, that was Melissa's grandmother's. Mm-hmm. And so it was, that's his fiddle to me. I mean, that's his sound, was playing on that fiddle. But, that last day I just sat by his bed and played fiddle tunes. He goes, well, play this. He did a really crafty thing, sort of toward the end. He would say, have you ever heard of a tune called, and he would mention, and he did this twice, ever heard of a tune called Grey Eagle? And I'd say, yeah. And he said, I always heard that was a good tune. He said, you ought to learn it and teach it to me. And so I went and I found a version of it that I liked, and I learned it, and I played it for him, and I really liked it. And he said, "I play." So what do you think? He said, "I don't believe there's a lot of music in that." He's kind of right. I mean, it's kind of a da 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 da. It's just kind of a, you know.
Yeah.
But. But yeah, he would send me out to learn. There were two tunes. He got me to learn Grey Eagle, and he got me to learn Shaking Down the Acorns. He said he always wanted to learn Shaking Down the Acorns. And so I went and learned it from these tapes I had of Burl and of Eden. And so I taught him how to play Shaking Down the Acorns. He really liked that. So I taught him to. But yeah, it was kind of a crafty thing to send me out and do that.
What do you both hope, I guess, first that will come out of the apprenticeship, but then also, you know, as the tradition continues, specifically Moses tunes and Greenbrier Valley tunes, what do you hope for the future?
Well, I was saying this to Paul at Vandalia this year. So I don't have any children, and Moses didn't have any children, and nobody's learned. I've taught people tunes and I've helped them get started a lot, but nobody's sat down and learned like a big chunk of tunes for me, and or paid any real attention to my style, which I get from Moe's and from some of these other players, from listening to these other players. And I said to Paul, I said, you know, you're getting old when you start to worry about what will happen to this music that I know. And I said, and I don't worry about it anymore. I said, because Annie's, I said, she really has such a touch for it and such an ear for it. I said, I don't worry about it. And, you know, so what I hope is that she'll keep playing these tunes and she'll, you know, throw all that other stuff away. And I'm mostly kidding. Wilson Douglas one time heard me play the banjo in public. First time I ever played it in public. And it was at Melvin Wine's birthday party, and everyone was so encouraging. And I got out, and Wilson was at the way back of the room, and you had to sort of walk this gauntlet. It was at the Landmark Theater in Sutton. And Melvin congratulated me. Everybody congratulated me. And I got out to the out to the door, and Wilson was standing there. And he said, well, Doug, I'll tell you what you should do. And I said, what's that, Wilson? He says, take that banjo and give it to someone you hate.
Wow.
So, but I'm, he was partially kidding, and I'm mostly kidding. But no, I just hope that she keeps playing these tunes and keeps. Mose said to me that we didn't have to do an apprenticeship because people were generous with him and shared these tunes with him, and that's all he was doing with me. He said, I'll show you, but if somebody asks you, you have to show them. That's how it works. And so I just hope that she'll keep showing them to other people and they'll stay alive and they'll just keep going around the world.
Yeah. Yeah, let me think about what the question was again. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's been really, like, the apprenticeship is really exciting because it is this really direct connection to the place where I'm from. You know, like, when Doug's telling me stories that Moses told him, like, I know all of those places. Like, that's where I grew up. I spent a lot of time. I had a bunch of friends that were out past, like, Frankfurt and Rennick, so I was through there constantly. You know, and I don't know. I mean, I think I'm really excited to learn those things. I see myself probably living in the area again someday. You know, I'm in Morgantown now, but whenever I get more settled, I've taught in the past. I've always wanted to teach, and that's something that's really exciting to me, and that's something that I feel like I kind of, you know, I was being trained classically. I did have some exposure to it through my teacher, who was good at having that, but there wasn't really anybody in the area talking about old time or the musical traditions in the same way that I think I could do, you know, if I moved home. So, like, that's something that I've always really, really been interested in doing and, like, would love to do, and, like, I hope to be, like, a good steward of these tunes, you know, and those stories, and, like, be able to pass those down, because that's something really important to me, both for, you know, anybody in the area, and then also, yeah, like, friends and family, and because I think there's a lot of people that really love that music and, again, like, don't know much about it or don't know that it's there or, like, how to find it necessarily, because it's, I know how to find it because I know the right people, but it's kind of hard to find if you don't know where to look, I guess.
You know, I also hope that this apprenticeship in a different form, I was going to say, I hope this apprenticeship doesn't end with my death, but I kind of hope that it does, but just in a different form and many, many years from now. I hope that we continue to play tunes together and that we have the opportunity to play tunes together for other people and to perform together in the future, as well as just playing together for our own edification and just for fun. And yeah, so I hope that we, you know, I think we've become friends through this, and so, you know, I can imagine many years of trading tunes and drinking coffee or tea. Or yeah. We drink a lot of tea at Annie's house too. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what I hope for it. I hope that it follows its own after this sort of structured thing that we've put together, that our relationship, as both our friendship and our musical friendship, continues to grow in an organic way from here.
Is there anything else either of you would like to add?
I mean, I think so. Like another piece that's not as directly music related, but so my dad sells old books. His focus is early church theology, but he does have some like Greenbrier County stuff. And I've always been a little bit interested in some of the local history growing up, but I never did much with it. And it's actually been a little bit fun to like have something. So I was telling Doug last lesson, my dad has all these books about the manors and estates of Greenbrier County. You know, so we like went through his books of those and like got to look up and see if like there was any Kaufmans. And we like, you know, because I've heard some of the like I've gotten enough information, I guess, from like the stories that Doug has told, that, you know, because what the like his family were probably maybe Mennonites, and when they came to the area, and so like we were looking through, there's a bunch of Kaufmans in the area, so we were able to find like, oh, like I forgot, I have it written down, like here's so and so and so and so Kaufman who came to this area, and like why are they associated with the same family, and like the farmhouse that he lived in was associated with this. So there's a manor in Fort Spring called Stewart Manor, and the house that Mose lived in and his family lived in is also somehow associated with the Stewart family. So like, yeah, it's not clear like how those two families are related, because the Stewarts were kind of like a more wealthy, I guess it's probably German family in the area as well.
Scottish.
Yeah, Stewart. I don't know.
Kaufman was definitely German.
That's something that I've learned from Annie, and you found a William Moses Kaufman in like the 1800s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was Moses' full name, and he was born December 12th, 1905.
Okay.
So William Moses Kaufman, so that had to have been his like grandfather.
So that's been kind of fun, and that's actually one thing that, you know, outside of the apprenticeship, so there's a little like Williamsburg Historical Society, and like the Greenbrier Historical Society has some things, and like I'd love to go and like poke around a little bit more, because I feel like before I didn't really have enough to even look for to learn more about it, you know.
You should talk to Jimmy about it too, because
he may have items from the Kaufman family.
He probably does. Yeah.
he has
does.
Many items.
He has many items.
Yeah.
Well, and it's funny, is also during this apprenticeship, my father's gotten really into genealogy. He's about to turn 80, and he's gotten really into genealogy and whatnot. And that's when he came back, and he was like, no joke, direct line, General Andrew Lewis. And I was like, what? And so realized that I have this family connection to Greenbrier County that I didn't know about. And yeah, so that happened during this as well. So,
yeah. Well, it's a funny thing. It's fun because, you know, my family, both of my parents moved a lot. You know, like I said, my dad, his family, they were Assemblies of God missionaries. He spent time in Africa, like all over, like Wisconsin and the Midwest, like all over. And you know, so he didn't have a stable place that he grew up. And my mom, her father was in the Marines, and my grandma would never move with him. So he was basically gone for the entire time, the 20 years that he was serving, because he was stationed all over the place. And my grandma, my nana on my mom's side, like, lived all over New England and, like, raised 5 kids pretty much by herself. And when my grandfather came back, they had a horrible divorce. and so she didn't really have a stable place either. And I think about this a lot, because I've got a lot of friends from West Virginia and people who have a really long tie to the region, and how much some of this, like, I wonder sometimes, like, I had the opportunity to grow up very connected to, like, the physical land, right, that I grew up on. Like, I grew up on a farm. I was outside, like, all the time because I was homeschooled. It was great. But how, like, rewarding it is, I guess, to, like, learn about the musical and cultural traditions of the place that I'm from, even if my family in this particular Greenbrier County isn't necessarily connected there. Because I found that really meaningful. And it's, you know, and it's a funny thing, of course, too, that, like, I don't have an accent because I was homeschooled and both my parents are from out of state. But I worked for a while for a, like, farm, like, business service organization. And one of the women I worked for is originally from North Carolina. Or not before, but worked with us, was originally from North Carolina. And if anything, she has more of an accent than I do. But we could walk into the same meeting in Greenbrier County because I was from Greenbrier County and was born here. Like, I could walk into these meetings with these old guys that would, like, be like, oh, I know your dad, and, you know, we could, like, talk about this, and, like, she could not connect in that same way. You know, and it's funny how, in some ways, how short it takes for you to get in the community in that way, which was funny.
Yeah. And that's opposite of what a lot of people say about West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some of it is if you're born there.
Well,
and it doesn't matter if you have an accent.
Right.
What
yeah.
your experience
was. Yeah.
I don't think I have much of an accent. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my parents are both from Pittsburgh. And mm-hmm. Even though my... and also Elkins, I have this theory that Elkins is the southernmost reach of the Pittsburgh ecotone. It is, because, like, you get into Clarksburg and Fairmont, Morgantown, that people sound more like they're from Western Pennsylvania than they do from Southern West Virginia.
Yeah.
Like, Southern West Virginia is a whole different animal. Although my wife always points out when we go to the grocery store, when I run into somebody I went to high school with, she said, because then I can hear your accent. She said, and then it's just like, so, and I think as a contemporary person from West Virginia who is in academia and who travels around the country and around the world and performs and gives readings and things like this, you've got a code switch all the time. I mean, you've got a code switch all the time. Mm-hmm. I always admire, I've got a friend who's a novelist from like Western Kentucky, a guy named Alex Taylor, and he's just got this thick, thick Kentucky, and it doesn't matter where he goes, he sounds exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of admire that. Mm-hmm. I kind of like wish that I can't do it. I can't, it doesn't. And I did Shakespearean theater and community radio also, which is, if you want to beat an accent out of somebody, you know, put them in the theater and then on the air.
Right, right.
And so, yeah.
Well, some of the things that you're talking about with place and the stories that are coming out of your apprenticeship, I would just kind of suggest maybe looking for a way to share that, whether it's like a Humanities Council grant to do some kind of, I was imagining like a website with some of your recordings of Moe's and then some of maybe videos of you playing together and the stories. And but I don't know, maybe it's an exhibit, maybe it's, who knows what it is, but I think it'd be cool to do an additional project that comes out of the apprenticeship.
That would be a very cool idea. And I do want to say that while my roots on both sides go back really far in West Virginia, that, you know, neither of my parents were born in West Virginia, and I wasn't. I was born in Pennsylvania, but we moved here when I was, my dad was in graduate school, and his goal was always to move to West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And so I was born in Lewistown, Pennsylvania, and then my dad went to Penn State, and then he went and did his PhD in Salt Lake City, and he got his first teaching job in Connecticut. And then, you know, I was 9 when we moved to West Virginia, when we got to West Virginia.
Uh-huh.
But it's funny, my parents in this community are highly regarded. They're beloved people, but they're not from here. And I am from here.
Yeah.
And I'm from here because I went to school here and I was acculturated here. And I cared about, there's something about caring about the culture, doing something like in service of the culture,
mm-hmm.
service in service of the culture of a place that opens a door for to people.
Yeah, I found that.
And yeah, but that opens the door. If I think that the idea that people have about West Virginians not being, you know, welcoming, is if you expect them to conform to you and be like where you're, but if you, Paul always says this. He says I don't have an opinion because I'm not from here, because he's from Youngstown, Ohio. I said you moved here when you were, you know, 19, and you, unlike like the other back to the landers and the hippies that he knew, he went to work in town. He worked at the newspaper and he got to know his neighbors, and they taught him how to sew. Like, while the hippies were growing whatever they were growing in Lincoln County, like, Paul learned to plow with horses from these two old men that lived next door, and they saw that he wanted to learn and that he respected what they did and who they were, and they just showed him everything and did everything for him, and Woody and Earl, and they became great friends. That's what West Virginians are so tired of being made to feel less for being who they are and where they're from, that when people show up and say, this is great, please show me, please share with me, we'll bend over backwards to do. And I think West Virginians are some of the most welcoming people.
Yeah, for sure.
As long as you're respectful. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, they will slam the door in your face.
Yeah,
my dad talks about that a lot too, actually. Because when my dad first moved back to West Virginia, he was married previously, and him and his first wife had moved from Lancaster, Pennsylvania area. That's where her family was. And he talked about that. He always talked about it. The first year that they moved out to Williamsburg, he shaved his beard, and they went to the Methodist Church for a year before the Methodist Church got a Baptist preacher, I think. He said it was very odd. But my dad always talked about that, how, like, my dad was definitely part of the Back to the Land movement, but he associates himself with it, sort of, in that he grew up very religious. Back to the Land movement happened, wasn't anything for a while, and then when I was growing up, converted actually to Eastern Orthodoxy when I was 7. Kind of random. It is, yeah, it's gorgeous. They drive an hour and 10 minutes every Sunday to go to church still, because the closest church is Beckley. But so, you know, he never was a hippie, and that, like, they didn't have the parties, and he's not uptight, but kind of. But he always talked about that, and that's how he got hooked up with Miss Toothman too, in terms of, like, coming into a community and being like we want to live like this, and, like, being able to find the stuff. Because he always talked about that, actually, and still does, you know, the difference between the folks that, like, went up and started a commune by themselves and didn't really interact, mm-hmm. versus some of his friends that did try and interact a little bit more with the locals
who live there.
Yeah, yeah, like, to become more integrated in the full community.
And I think my mom did a lot for, I think mom's more from here than dad is, in a way. Even though most of their friends are from elsewhere, my mom, like, is learned to call square dances. Mm-hmm. She was really interested. She loves to dance. And so she had an apprenticeship with Lou Mayuri. And my mom was fascinated when we moved down here by White Oak Baskets, and so she makes the most beautiful, that's one of hers right there, that bread basket up there, mm-hmm. she makes the most beautiful White Oak Baskets, and she's still doing that today. I saw them this afternoon right before you guys got here, and I said, I've got to go, Annie and Emily are coming in. Mom said, oh, you know, well, very much like my mom, oh, you know, I did meet Emily. And I said, yes, I know. Yeah, yeah, and I said, well, she's here to do our site visitation. She goes, no, I know. She said, but you've reminded me that I have a tree I need to start splitting today. And so,
oh, cool.
Well, yeah,
I
so
get in touch with her soon.
You should, yeah. Anyway, but, I mean, they're both very, you know, they're very respectful people. They're very generous people. And they set a really great example about that. I mean, I think they modeled how to do that, but they came here late enough that they'll never be. I mean, they're important parts of the community, but they're not from here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've all
sort of made me think that I should do a podcast because this is a great conversation. But just so we don't run too long. Well, is there anything else you want to talk about?
Did you have the cabbage
story? Oh, yeah, the cabbage story. Oh. Let's get the cabbage story. So you have this photo here of a man, Otto Waugh.
Otis
Waugh. Okay, could you tell us about him?
Sure. So Otis Waugh was from Indian Draft in Pocahontas County. He lived in Indian Draft. He was actually from Campbelltown, where his father ran a grist mill in the 20s and 30s. As a matter of fact, that mill at Campbelltown is 90% of the mill that's at Babcock State Park. That was his father's mill that they moved. And so he told me all sorts of great stories about milling and about how when they would mill buckwheat has buckwheat, the hulls get in the stones. And so you have to clean the stones, and the way to clean it is you run corn through it, and corn would pull the hulls out of it. And so they couldn't just sell it as cornmeal because it had buckwheat in it too. And so they would sell it as dog meal. And people would bake, before people would buy store-bought bread or dog food. No, like dog food, like kibble. They would bake dog bread, like cornbread for their dogs. And they would use this meal that was like part buckwheat, part cornmeal for that. But anyway, Otis, I met when I was working at the Pocahontas Times. And he called me up to tell me that he had a 17.5-pound late flat Dutch cabbage with nary a crack. And he came, and it's about the size of a manhole cover. It's a huge cabbage. And he brought it down to the newspaper for me to photograph it and put it in the paper, which we did. And Otis showed up, and it was very warm, sweet guy. He just had cataract surgery, so he had these really dark sunglasses and his Napa racing team hat on, kind of cattywampus, and his shirt buttoned up to the collar, and these great gnarled hands. And I took this picture of him holding this huge cabbage that we ran in the newspaper. But he and I became friends, and he would call me up every now and again and say, "Van Gundy, cabbage boy. Why don't you feel like coming up and visiting?" And I'd say, "Sure." I'd say, "Bring your fiddle." And so I'd bring the fiddle up, and he would sit with his rotary phone and call all of his cousins. And his father had been a fiddler. He would call his cousins and say, you know, "Dave, Otis, listen to this." And he'd hold the phone out, and I would fiddle something into the phone. And then he'd take it back and say, "Doesn't that sound like Dad? Okay, bye." Click. And then he'd call somebody else, and I'd spend the afternoon doing this. And then he'd send me home with a coffee can full of cornmeal, because he still had a set of burr stones, and he ran on the power takeout on his tractor. And so he still ground his own corn in the barn, and he would send me home with this wonderful stone ground cornmeal that made cornbread. I'm not kidding you, it would rise up 5 inches out of the pan. It was just the most beautiful, beautiful cornbread. It was so good. It was so nutty and delicious.
Pretty light.
It was really light and airy.
The only
airy
cornbread I've ever had that does that is, or with like the Bloody Butcher.
Yeah, this is Bloody Butcher.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, he only grew Bloody Butcher.
Yeah, okay.
And he said that's the only corn to make cornmeal. And so he grew, it was all Bloody Butcher, and he knew how to grind it. He learned from his dad, and he would always send me home with a coffee can full of cornmeal, and we would make cornbread from it. And then whenever he'd call, I'd be happy to come up and play fiddle over the phone for 2 hours in exchange for a can of cornmeal.
What did he do with that cabbage?
So his sister was still alive, and he said, you know, he planted, I think, 16 cabbages that year, and this was the biggest one. He said, but there wasn't one that was under 10 pounds. And so he had like 200 pounds of cabbage, and they made sauerkraut. He said that's what they made all year. I mean, every year. And they made sauerkraut, and he said half of it we make as regular kraut, and half of it they make as what he called sweet kraut. And the sweet kraut, they would put thin slices of red bell pepper in it. Like, he grew bell peppers, and you put bell peppers in it and just let it go to sauerkraut also. And
so no sugar, just
no, just the bell peppers in it. And that added just a little bit of sweetness to it, but it was just, you know, just the lactobacillus, whatever was in on the kraut that makes kraut, just salt. And and I've actually made, I make sauerkraut every fall, and I always make one jar with bell peppers in it, thinking of Otis.
I have one more. Oh, did he have a secret to grow them so large?
Not that he shared with me.
Just really good soil.
Really good soil. Yes, yeah, so this is Indian Draft up around Edrey, so just north of Marlinton. When I was working surveying power lines in that area, I walked up on this guy's farm, and he wanted to know what I was doing there. It was up at the end of the electric service. This is up above Woodrow. And he said, so I told him and I showed him, and he said, "Want to see something I bet you never seen?" And it's always with a little trepidation, but I always say, "Sure." And so he says, "Just stand right there." And he had hilled his potatoes, but this was like October or November. And so the potatoes were hilled, but it was just soil, and he had planks running out through him. And he walked out, and he was in his 70s or 80s, and he walked out, and he got down on one knee, and he stuck his arm into the ground. And I mean, stuck his arm into the potato hill, and he felt around, and he pulled out a potato that was as big as my head. And I said, "Good God." And he said, "25 years ago, I brought a load of horse manure up here. I bought out," and this helped this guy sweep out his barn. And so it was just manure and hay. And he said, for 20 years, I just kept turning it and turning it and turning it. And he said, 5 years ago, I started as my potato patch. I moved my potato patch into it. And he said, I only ever walk on that board. And he said, the secret is so that the potatoes have room, so the soil doesn't compact them, and they have room to grow. And it was firm, and he let me hold it, and I was looking at it, I was like, "This is beautiful." And in my head, I thought, he's sending me home with this amazing, huge potato. And he goes, "Yep, that's a pretty nice potato." And then he took it back. I was like, "Yes, it is, sir. Thank you for showing it to me." So I don't know, maybe a lot of the old timers there grew their gardens in composted manure.
Just so I have it, can you introduce yourself again and tell me who you are, where you're from, and what year you were born?
Doug Van Gundy from Elkins, West Virginia. I was born in 1966.
I'm Annie Stroud. I was born in Williamsburg, West Virginia in 1988.
All right. Thank you both so much. This is a great conversation.